You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
Okay, we're going to turn to the next panel now on opportunities and challenges under new conditions in mainland China. My name is Bonnie Glaser. I'm a senior advisor for Asia in the Freeman Chair for China Studies at the Center for Strategic and International Studies, and want to thank Brookings for hosting this conference here today. So we have a terrific panel to talk about some of the recent developments in mainland China, the rise to power of the fifth generation of leaders, the nature of Xi Jinping and his presidency, the degree of power that he holds, and his aspirations to shape and implement the China dream, the economic challenges that China faces. So all of these issues are going to be addressed on this panel as we listen to four very distinguished speakers analyze the new conditions in mainland China. We are going to start with Dr. Zhao Jianmin, and you all have a bio, so I will just introduce Dr. Zhao as a professor and director at the Graduate Institute of Mainland China Studies, and Dr. Sun Yat-sen's thoughts at Chinese Culture University. And I think, as you all know, he used to be deputy minister at the Mainland Affairs Council in Taiwan. I understand that he has a PowerPoint. If somebody could get that up, we'd appreciate it. And I'll turn the floor over to you, Dr. Zhao.
Thank you.
Thank you, Bonnie. Let me see how this works. Okay. Well, I thought that among the many issues, I thought I'd concentrate on the reforms that Xi Jinping is promoting. Seems to me this is the thing that the leadership of the fifth generation of Chinese leadership is focusing on. Some people said the reform passed last year at the third session of the CC session of the 18th Party Congress. It's a 5-in-1 reform package. Some said it would either lead to a great governance if it succeeds in the future, or to a great disorder, 大治 or 大乱. I think this is a good assessment because a lot is at stake, and we are really seeing a grand package there. So I thought I would just review how the reform package has been going on up to this point, and what are the future prospects. First, I try to figure out what is behind Xi Jinping's thinking. Why, in other words, why reforms? Seems to me the old model, which is basically a growth-driven development model, has met with obstacles. And seems to me there are three major obstacles, and these are the foundation, seems to me, that has alarmed the top leadership in Beijing and, driving them on the path towards reforming the system. The first is, of course, market mechanism has been greatly distorted, especially in resources in the areas of energy, telecommunications, transportation, and finance. They are being distributed unfairly in favor of the state-owned enterprises, although the non-public sector accounts for 80% of employment in the urban area, and 60% of the GDP, and 50% of taxes levied by the government. So this is really a huge mistake, and huge problem. Especially the state-owned enterprises, they are less efficient. I think there's a figure. I think their profit the margin is about less than 2% overall for the state-owned enterprises compared to the non-public sector, and yet they're accepting the lion's share of the resources. So this is really a source of public discontent, also obstacle to further economic vitality. The first, of course, is the income disparity is widening. This is across regions and across professions and it's all over the place. And it is another source of great public discontent. I think they need to address this issue, issue of unfairness. The third problem is that it seems to me a corporate structure is already in a place featuring the state and the capitalist class, which are basically, coming from the state-owned enterprises. They are forming a coalition. They preempt the changes. So it seems to me these are the major. Of course, we are looking at a great deal of a great many of our problems, but I think all those problems might come down to the three. So how do they, do it? The decision adopted at the third session of the CCR session last year, it's called the Decision on Major Issues Concerning Comprehensively Deepening Reforms. In the rest of the presentation, I simply refer to the decision as the decision. The decision is aimed at reshaping the state society structure, so that a more equitable society might emerge. I think this is the most important core element of the reform. The decision is also a response, official response coming from Xi Jinping and his peers to the debate. We all remember this great debate that started some 15 years ago at the turn of the century, and it's ongoing. Over where China is headed. Some are saying that the so-called Chinese motto is basically based on this statism, where the state-owned enterprises play a very important role. The state is also playing a very important role. But some others are suggesting this motto is really not working because it's becoming state capitalism and so on and so forth. I think this is an official response coming from the Chinese bureaucracy on the debate. And I think Xi Jinping wants to offend neither aside. I think he's taking a central position on this great debate. Then I try to examine the contents of the so-called 5-in-1 reform package, because it covers five areas, including economic, political, cultural, societal, and environmental reforms. But I think there are, the targets are only two. I think these two are the most important areas. The two are most important among the five, which are economic reform and judicial reform, because I think the two are the most important things. First, market reform. I think the main objective is to establish a fair mechanism so that the improper linkage between the state and the market can be corrected. I think this is, like I said earlier, this has been a major issue. If that's the core objective, I think we can further speculate on two sub-objectives, which is market liberalization. This is extremely important, because like I said, all those resources are being monopolized by state-owned enterprises, and there is indeed a need for further liberalization. Second, how to reshape the role of the state. In other words, relationship between the state and the market. I think those are the main objectives. Then how do they do it in terms of a market reform? First is to redefine the role of the market. We all remember in the 16th Party Congress, the market is defined as a fundamental force in the allocation of resources. 基础性作用, fundamental force, that was defined by the 16th Party Congress, and the line was continued into the 17th Party Congress. But I think at the, in the decision adopted last year at the 三中全会, the third plenary session, this has been changed to the market has been redefined as the determining force, 决定性作用, used to be fundamental 作用, right now it's a 决定性作用 in the distribution of resources. This has been to many. This has been held as the most important change by the decision, and some would even call this spirit of the document. I concur with that assessment. The second thing they are doing is that they are trying to reduce market mechanism intervention. The decision demanded a loosening up control over investment. If you look at the Shanghai Free Trade Pilot Zone, they have already come up with a new policy for market access. In this, where they identify a few items where they are not, people are not allowed to invest, whereas rest of the items are open for investment. So I think this is a huge progress. They are also trying to cut back on the administration powers. They have been doing this for the past decade plus, 10, 15 years. In a new decision made just a few days ago, the powers enjoyed by the state council have been further cut. Some said about 60% of the, on this round of reshaping of the government's powers over, deciding relating to the market. I think some said that 60% of the powers have been shipped off. So this is a huge, thing there. Another thing is, of course, state-owned enterprises. I'm sorry, that's state-owned enterprises. The decision demanded change over the management system, and also they introduced the mixed ownership system. And this has been promoted by a number of provinces. I think right now it's gaining vogue there. On the government, that's another important area. The decision urged the budgetary transparency. I think this is a very important reform over the budget. I suspect this has something to do with the fact that Xi Jinping, when he was at Zhejiang, you remember the budgetary reforms there, right? But they tried to bring in more people into the system to review the budget. I suppose that's the motto they, that's the thing they tried to introduce. And peasants were given more freedoms to dispose the land they till and the land surrounding their residence. This is very important because this is a very source that contributing the discontent coming in the rural area. Last, urbanization will continue to be promoted. This is Li Keqiang's pet project in order to offset the problems of the rural unemployment and income disparity. Okay, the second reform, major reform, is on judicial reforms. As you know, in the past year and over a year, over 40 top level officials have been under investigation in the name of corruption. And, you know, quite a few measures have been taken. Just recently, the group, the small leading group over comprehensively deepening reforms, they passed a framework opinions concerning experiments in judicial reforms. A number of places have been singled out for that experiment. And in August last year, the Politburo also passed an anti-graft 5-year plan, but unfortunately, no contents have been made public yet. Last, challenges and future prospects. I think the whether the reform is to be successful is contingent upon the determination of the top leadership. And for that, Xi Jinping decided to establish the small leading group over comprehensively deepening reforms. The group is tasked to function to design, coordinate, push forward, and supervise implementation of the reforms. But there are problems. Problem number one is that the small leading group, the decision-making body, is basically a party organ. How would party organ work with the different agencies at the State Council? I think that would be a problem because most of the reforms would be are to be implemented by the State Council. Second issue, and many people have been talking about this, Xi Jinping has emerged as the most powerful leader in China after Deng Xiaoping. Some calculate he has 10 different hats. Just recently, he has been added four hats, four very important hats. He's now right now head of the small leading group over the deeply, reform. Then he's also head of the National Security Council and the small leading group on internet safety and the telecommunication, and also the small leading group on deepening national defense and the military. So that's, last, SEF, state-owned enterprises, are still defined as the basis of the socialist market economy. So that would put a huge constraint on the, to the scope where they may go. Very last sentence regarding the judicial reform. I think the major problem is with the constitution, because the constitution says the people's congress has control over the personnel operation of the judicial sector. But in the meantime, the people's congress at various localities are still being headed by the party secretaries. So the judicial independence that Xi Jinping has been talking about seems to me is rather unrealistic. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Zhao. We're now going to turn to Dr. Cai Wenxuan, who is Assistant Research Fellow at the Institute of Political Science at the Academic Seneca in Taiwan. Dr. Cai.
Hello, everybody. My name is Wenxuan Cai, the Assistant Research Fellow at the Academic Seneca in Taiwan. It's my pleasure to join the conference. The topic is the Xi Jinping's political agenda of the Chinese dream and the priority domestic problem in China. We know in 2012, Xi Jinping put forward his guiding ideology, Chinese dream or China dream, 中国梦. Xi Jinping emphasized, we must practice the innovation of China. And everybody must to every Chinese people must to be prolonged to our history, culture, and the legacy. And Xi Jinping emphasized the CCP must to practice the economic growth and the social development so that we can the China can reappear the Tang Dynasty or Han Dynasty is a very glorious dynasty in Chinese accent. Okay. In addition, Xi Jinping emphasized if we want to practice Chinese dream, we must to resolve lots of social problems. This topic was discussed by Professor Zhao Jianmin. Xi Jinping believed after 1980, Deng Xiaoping carried out the open and reform policy. Actually, Deng Xiaoping practiced the initial modernization in China. However, lots of social problems and the sequela has not resolved until now. Three problems are very important. First is the social unfairness. Second, environmental protection. Third, the anti-corruption. The three issues are very important in contemporary China and is very imperative. Xi Jinping believes if we cannot resolve this problem, we cannot practice the Chinese dream. Okay? So after 2012 in National Party Congress, Xi Jinping put forward a term, so-called 深化改革, deepened reform comprehensively. He believed we must to change the gradual reform that created by Deng Xiaoping. We must to do a comprehensive reform to resolve the three problems in contemporary China. The first problem is Xi Jinping believed we must to resolve the current wide income gap between different members of society. Okay? Actually, it's not a new policy. In Xi's era, in Hu Jintao's era, CCP ever put forward a turn. We can see the photo on the left, on the left, Xiao Kang, it means let everybody richer, equal richer. And Xiao Kang, it means way of society, or Xiao Kang Shehui, way of society, or of long society. And Xi Jinping sixth in the policy, and Xi Jinping emphasized, we must to abolish the Xiao Kang Shehui in 1920 is a very clear schedule, and we can see the photo on the right photo, right side. To achieve the purpose, Xi Jinping investigated and surveyed less of the poor province. In the 2013, Xi Jinping investigated the Hunan province, a very poor province in the middle China, and he surveyed some minority area in this province, and he referred his policy. Every country must to increase the funding to support this poor area, and it's not a slogan. Okay, it's a very very important policy. And the second, the relative policies in 2014, Xi Jinping put forward the Hukou system reform. Hukou means household register. We now in China have the two Hukou, rural Hukou and the urban Hukou. If the people have the own the urban Hukou, it means it will show the more social wealth and the social resource, and the people cannot change the Hukou freely. So lots of scholars believe the Hukou system is one of the crucial factor to cause the China's unfairness until now. So in 2013, Xi Jinping changed the system. He allowed the people to migrate from his current resident to into the new one. It means people can migrate freely and from the urban to rural or rural to urban. And it breaks the liberty of Hukou system. So some scholars believe it is a very, very important reform of the social management after 1980. The second problem is environmental protection. We know there is a very, very serious problem in China. Actually, it's not also Xi Jinping's new style. In 2013, CCP put forward a new term, so-called, you can see the photo on the right side, 生态文明, ecological civilization. Okay? Hu Jintao believes we cannot sacrifice the environmental natural environment for the sake of economic growth. Okay, and Xi Jinping also follows Hu Jintao's policy and he believes the civilization, ecological civilization is very important. So he organized lots of the official press and the propaganda department to publish lots of books. You can see the photo on the left. One book is so-called the entitled is How to Practice the Beautiful Chinese Dream. The ecological civilization is a new area. So Xi Jinping hoped to co-extend between the ecological civilization and the economic growth. And the relative policy, the state council, Wu Yuan assigned eight inspection group in 2014, Wu Yuan. Okay, the group go to the central and the province to check, to inspect this leader, whether this leader follow China's central policy. One crucial policy is environmental protection. For example, this inspector group go into the relative province and check whether the leader decrease the high polluting industry step by step and whether you develop the green industry or upgrading the industry. Okay, it's in other words, they also protection the social stability. We know if the CCP, if the professional leader closes the industry, maybe it causes lots of worker lose their job and cause the social stability, cause the social unrest, social chaos. So the inspector asked this leader, when you close this industry, how do you handle the resentment of this unemployed worker from the closing industry? So it can reflect Xi Jinping's idea. We must to push the comprehensive reform, cannot to resolve the problem, however, cause another problem. The third problem is anti-corruption. It's a very, very important policy. Xi Jinping reaffirmed his policy in very several times. We must to swat the fly and the tiger simultaneously. The fly means the low cadre, low level cadre, and the tiger means the senior or high level cadre. The performance of the anti-corruption seems very good because until now, over 13 senior cadre, I mean the ministry level cadre or over level, dismissed. And due to their corruption, included these two tigers, Zhou Yongkang and Xu Caihou. So Xi Jinping believes the bottom people and the cadre believe the corruption is one most serious problem in contemporary China. If we can't resolve the problem, we cannot practice the Chinese dream. So in my mind, Chinese dream involves three very important domestic problems. Social unfairness and environment protection and anti-corruption. Xi Jinping emphasizes if we can resolve the problem and we and China can practice the Chinese dream further. In addition, we can see some very interesting. Xi Jinping, in order to practice the Chinese dream or anti-corruption, he observed and emerged lots of Mao Zedong. Slogan and the style and the major. We now he asked every cadre to do the criticize and the self criticize, 自批评与自我批评. It's a very mouse slogan. And he said we must to follow the misline, 走群众路线, to check if we have the correct political attitude or behavior and follow the central policy and the direction. In 2013, Xi Jinping launched a very interesting movement, so-called 党的群众路线教育, the party's misaligned education. He practiced the rectification within the party. So we can find Xi Jinping very, very good to create a collective pressure over the party's member, over the party's cadre, to practice his idea, his guiding ideology smoothly. And the very particular style has not been found in Hu Jintao and Jiang Zemin. Okay. And the Chinese dream maybe be the Xi Jinping very important political symbol. Xi Jinping maybe follow his predecessor, Deng Xiaoping, Jiang Zemin, Hu Jintao. We know every CCP's top leader must to put forward his particular ideology or alternative. For example, 其实邓小平 is socialist market economic economy, 社会主义市场经济 and 习近平 is 江泽民 is socialist representative 三个代表，胡锦涛 is socialist outlook on development 社会发展观。 So maybe the Chinese dream will be the 习近平 political symbol and soft power, and maybe it will write into the party'sconstitution in the future. However, this is a possible criticism. Is Chinese dream, let somebody think of another similar dream, American dream. It's a political error to learn Western term to be your ideology. So Xi Jinping organized lots of scholars to write the paper, emphasize the idea of Chinese dream was derived from the Chinese culture, Chinese idea, no any association with Western culture. And Xi Jinping not only propaganda the Chinese dream to the Chinese people, he also hoped let the world hear the sound of Chinese dream to enhance his legitimacy, enhance his soft power. For example, Xi Jinping asked the propaganda department and the Chinese Foreign Language Bureau, 中国外文局, to recruit lots of translators and to publish lots of translated books. They collect the material of the practice document or the leaders speaking or some propaganda piece to translate from the Chinese into the English. You can know the Chinese dream. Let everybody, let the world to hear the Chinese dream. More interesting is, Xi Jinping attended the London Book Fair in 2013, and the CCP rented a position in the exhibition, and hoped the every Western people to approach this greater publicity material. Okay, so we can. So my conclusion is, the Chinese dream, yes, is Xi Jinping's soft power, and Xi Jinping, it is an overarching concept and hope to resolve the three problems, social unfairness, the environmental protection, and anti-corruption. And so Chinese dream, maybe a fairness dream, maybe a rich dream, maybe a strong army dream. However, unfortunately, it is absolutely not a dream of democracy. Actually, Xi Jinping prefer the administrative reform, prefer to centralize, to enhance the government ability rather than participatory democracy. So Chinese dream no any implication of democracy, participate in the Western democracy. So we can find the reform line and to see the Xi Jinping's political bottom line. Any reform, for example, social fairness, environmental protection, and anti-corruption purpose is to help China, help the CCP to increase their ruling ability to assure their regime survive regime protection. Xi Jinping has no any intention to share the power with the civil society. So we can find it reflects Xi Jinping's ruling thinking. It's my presentation. Thank you for listening. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Tsai. Our next speaker is Professor David Lampton, who is here at SAIS, the George and Sadie Hyman Professor of China Studies and Director of the China Studies Program. Over to you, Mike.
Well, thank you, Bonnie, and thank Brookings and the Association of Foreign Relations for putting this together. And let me join my colleague on the last panel, David Brown. Welcome you all to SAIS. We're not a sponsor, but we're glad to have it here and expose our students and our community to the good thinking that you're hearing this morning and we'll hear this afternoon. I've been asked to speak for 12 minutes, and you should feel free to cut me off at 12 minutes. I'm planning on observing that. And basically, it seems to me the question put in sort of colloquial form that I've been asked to answer is, what is going on in China? And I think that's a good question, actually. My presentation will be at one level higher generalization than the very good presentations you just heard, because I think there are some very basic questions, at least I have, and most of the people I talk to have, about what's going on in China. I think this is a particularly important topic because I believe foreign policy basically has, if not all its roots, at least a lot of its roots in domestic politics. So if we're, as Americans or people living in Taiwan or indeed in China's region, the rest of the world, I think we have to be concerned about Chinese politics if we're going to get some sort of handle over where this very large and dynamic society is headed. I just want to say one other thing prefatory about domestic politics. I think we're in probably for a rough couple of 3 or 4 years, just to bracket the next period, and it'll partly be so because not only of the dynamics in Chinese politics, but it's going to be interacting with a very lively political situation in the United States. Whatever you want to say, we're going to have a new government after our elections. Taiwan has the elections, both provincial and presidential, coming up. Hong Kong has its chief executive elections, and we're already into a, let's say, an interesting and probably many would say problematic process there. So it's not just Chinese domestic politics, but it's going to be how Chinese domestic politics is playing into the domestic politics of these other very salient societies. So I think we're in for an interesting, I don't want to say perilous, but I would say probably rough ride for the next few years. If I'm optimistic, it's only a few years. I guess the thing that I would start out by saying is that I'm a little confused, in the sense that I believe the last 35 years have changed Chinese system and society very fundamentally. That is to say, the bureaucracy, the relative leadership dominance, it's become more fragmented. That Chinese society itself has become more fragmented in interest groups. We heard earlier talk about interest groups. I broadly agree with that. And society has become more empowered in terms of its the money available to lower levels of the system, information, human talent, capacity to mobilize it. So Chinese society has changed very fundamentally. So then the question is, if the ambition is to restore strongman leadership, is this really a feasible undertaking? Or does it have high prospects of success? I think you started out your presentation, Professor Zhao, saying there are two big alternatives here. One is great rule and the other is great disorder. I think that's... So that sort of covers the range of possibility here. And unfortunately, none of them are zero probability, right? So in any case, I think that is a basic question. I was struck by a recent statement that Xi Jinping made at the 60th anniversary of the National People's Congress, and he said, cadres must adhere to the central leadership of the party and approve overall coordination to prevent the government from becoming leaderless and fragmented. The government must prevent political fighting and wrangling between political parties. So it seems to me that what his attempt to will say, get a higher degree of strongman leadership is anchored in the very facts of how Chinese society and polity have changed over the last 30 to 40 years. So I have that sort of basic question. Secondly, I think you have to ask the question. I think it was mentioned, I forget, by one of my, I think it was you, Professor Zhao, said Xi Jinping is in charge of about 10 committees. I think the number 10 was, I think it may be more than 10, but there are all these cross-system integrating committees that exist. You put up some of the major ones. I think you have to ask a question. What is the feasible span of control of an effective span of control of an individual? I don't know what the answer to that question is, but that seems to me pushing or exceeding the limits. So I would just say, in a sense, we can phrase it as he has consolidated power faster than others, is the way it's often put. Yes, but can your grasp exceed your reach? And so I think we need to ask that question. Then I would say we've got the issue of policy oversight and implementation. Now, when I ask myself, who is the authoritative spokesman in broad policy areas after Xi Jinping? I can certainly say in anti-corruption, Wang Qishan seems to me to be the trusted lieutenant in that area. But pick the rest of your policy areas and say, who's the trusted spokesman that's in charge of that area who speaks authoritatively? And I'm at a loss frequently to answer that. And when I ask Chinese coming through my office, they seem to be at a loss. So I think we need to look at that set of issues. Now, second whole question is, in a sense, how is Xi trying to consolidate his power, become a strong man, if that's a fair characterization? And I think the answer is fairly clear at the general level. He's pursuing a nationalistic a rhetoric and populism and anti-corruption. And heaven knows anti-corruption is justifiably a popular topic to address in China. But I think you have to be practical, and you have to say addressing or having these two themes of nationalism and anti-corruption also creates some difficulties. Certainly the anti-corruption is aimed at key power structures within China. And I expect those power structures aren't going to take this lane down. So I have a lot of Chinese that I talk to say, we're just keeping our heads down until we see which way this thing is going. Well, so we probably ought to keep our analytic heads down and wait a little bit to see how this sorts out. In terms of nationalism, of course, it creates anxiety in the region. And not limited to the region, but certainly in the region. And then you see China moving a little bit closer to Russia, whatever closer to Russia means. But it's hard for me to imagine Chinese people see their future in Russia. After this last 40 years, it's pretty hard for me to see that. So it seems to me, the third thing you need to, I think, be fair, and it relates to particularly the two presentations, that is there has been a very impressive reform agenda laid out. And I think we have to say that. And my own belief is if China could get on and implement its 60 points in a fairly comprehensive, orderly way, it could extend its period of rapid growth for another decade or two. I think there's a lot of potential there. But I don't see the rapid movement down that list of 60 points, although I'll concede that the negative list, the Shanghai zone, all of these are good things. I'm entirely supportive. But it seems to me this corruption and nationalism could derail or at least slow down your capacity to tackle that key agenda. I want to end by just observing that, you know, this is the 110th anniversary of the birth of Deng Xiaoping. And there's a lot to be said about Deng Xiaoping, but I think he had two core elements of his strategy. And I just ask you to think about what you see going on in China in light of those two core elements. I think in the previous panel, somebody, I think it was maybe Doug Paul, said that Tao Guangyang Hui, the hide and bide, or however we want to translate that, has sort of been, I don't know if his verb was buried or something to that effect. But it seems to me Deng had two core elements to his strategy. One is pacify the outside so you can focus internally. And the second is don't bite off more than you can chew. Don't take on more political enemies than you can handle. Tackle the easy things domestically before you go for the hard things, and use the capital you accumulated on your successes to tackle the more difficult things. And frankly speaking, I don't see that strategy at work now. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We will now turn to our last speaker, Dr. Liu Xiaobo, a professor of political science at Barnard College. Dr. Liu.
Thanks, Bonnie. Let me actually pick up where Mike Blumpton just raised that question at the beginning of his remarks, that puzzles him, which also indeed puzzles me, and that is that, why China, we know that China, after 30-some years of reform, there's huge, a tremendous social change, yet there seems to be a gap of how to deal with those social change. And that seems to be the kind of one of the key issues, not for just us, but also for all China watchers and those who are interested in Chinese domestic politics. I think it's not a cliche. It's almost a cliche to say that China is at crossroads. I think there are two reasons why I say it is not that cliche, because now we're not only having a new leadership under Xi Jinping, but also the tremendous social change. Let me just, sort of focus on that social change and make a few analysis of how the government and a new leadership might deal with it. When we talk about social change, I think we could observe at least three trends. I think previous speakers already touched upon them. Number one is that, there's an increasing number of people that can be now called urban middle class. So you have an emerging middle class in China. I'll talk a little bit about the implication of that. And second, others mentioned that there's increasingly diverse social interests. State sectors, big monopolies, urban middle class. You have migrants and so on. So they're increasingly diverse social interests. And thirdly, you have this gap between economic achievement, economic development, and lack of social political reform. So the institutional between demands and institutions and the way of deal with those new demands. And also the social, with this kind of social change, also we observe that the concerns of the Chinese society at large as a whole have seemingly changed with this increasing number of people that can be called middle class. I would call that change is fundamentally changed from a so-called concerns of pocket issues such as inflation, unemployment, economic crisis, and so on, to what I call quality of life concerns. Typical middle class, again, this is not unique Chinese, but typical middle class concerns. And if you look at China today, you can notice that the concerns are no longer just unemployment or inflation, but rather food safety, air quality. And also there's another interesting, a lot of people haven't really noticed, is also the concern about leisure time, about travel, how many holidays they have, how to do those, whether to switch around those long weekend holidays. So the concerns have changed. And, of course, about taxes, about corruption. So you can see that this new middle class-driven kind of concerns have emerged in China. And that raises a critical question. How does the Chinese regime deal with it? Or has it, because from political science, those classic theory about democratization, about modernization, now we're seeing China has entered, again, a very interesting period of time. After 30-some years of reform, we know China now have an emerging middle class. Martin Lipset has predicted that could lead to political change, possibly to democratization. And not that, 20 years, some years ago, Huntington has predicted that, when countries enter this transition zone, When the GDP per capita enter above $3,000 roughly and under 10,000, China exactly in that zone. China last year, 2013, China's GDP per capita was $6,000 roughly. So that China is in that zone, and we see the kind of a social change. And the question is, why not? Why we have not seen a kind of change? So this actually is one of the key issues that China scholars now focus on, that is, authoritarian resilience. This is not just in China field, but also in the comparative politics field, is why then some authoritarian regime remain resilient despite all the changes elsewhere. So they haven't caught on the virus of democratization. So the answer, I think, let me quickly make some remarks about. I think there are four possible answers to that. What the Chinese regime has done, and we can discuss the challenge of using those you know, those four possible ways of managing it. Number one, I would say it's governance reform without political reform. So there is institutional adaptation, adjustment without fundamental political change. You know, previous speakers, Mike Limpton, all touch upon those. You know, judicial reforms, reforms of hukou, household registration, all right? Bureaucratic reforms, downsizing. You know, Li Keqiang continued this, you know, last two premiers, Zhou Zhongji started this, you know, transition, transforming bureaucracy from that of a player to referee, if you will. And Wen Jiabao continued that trend, and then now Li Keqiang go even further. But still, those are governance reforms without fundamental political reforms. And the second one, and that worked to some extent, and I will come back to it again. Second one, I will say, is state capacity, particularly fiscal capacity. Until the 80s, 90s, for the first 20 years, the Chinese actually, if you look at the fiscal capacity at the time, after mid-1990s reform, fiscal reform, decentralization, and you see a trend at that time that local governments was increasingly short of money. What they did was to tax local population. This is famous peasant burden issues, which Tom Bernstein and I wrote on. And so at that time, government had to rely on taxing local population, which caused a lot of problems. That was when there's 100,000 protests every year. We don't see that many now, and there's a reason to it. So, and because of that, they're being taxed heavily. Now, of course, in the last 10 years or so, that government has switched its tactic and it no longer tries to tax local population, especially by the local government. Now is what? It was what I called revenue without taxation. The main source of which is land, is land sale, land proceeds. And that has benefited tremendously Chinese governments, especially at the local level. And that also avoided kind of directly taxing local population. You develop, infrastructure, even including put money into this Weiwen, maintaining stability while not directly taxing people. So I argue that is another reason why we see a kind of a stability or the regime is resilient. The third one is control of critical goods. While providing public goods, infrastructures, services. Even you go to Chinese countryside, you really see now villages got a lot of money even into medical services and so on. So Chinese actually government pumped too money. So they do provide public goods while they control critical goods. And this is not my theory, but rather the theory of some scholars in comparative politics. They argue that authoritarians now today are smart. They are not just, cut off public goods. They actually provide public goods, but they control critical goods. What are critical goods that Chinese government try to control? Information, organization. Those are two key areas. I think Chinese government has, really put a tight leash on. Information. As we know, there's rising, emerging social media and a lot of, but that control attempt to make the information control, I think it's quite there. And then organization. China has a lot of freedom. Chinese society now quite free. Individually, the space is quite expanded, yet any organizational space is still very much limited. Finally, decentralization. Well, decentralization usually is taken upon as a reason why Chinese economy has developed. But I also suggest that decentralization also had an interesting political consequence. That is to disaggregate this legitimacy problem. So if any problem occur, it's the local governments. It's the local monks that did not recite the scripts right. So that's an intended or unintended consequence of this decentralization. So the central government, Beijing, always can blame the local. And that's, in fact, that's survey results by Asian Parameter, actually, Professor Zhu and Professor Zhu Yunhan and others, has shown that, indeed, that's how Chinese regard legitimacy. They trust the central government more than local governments. And that, I argue, is a decentralized result. And finally, let me say that all of this becoming more and more increasingly hard. All these four areas becoming increasingly hard. Just take one example. It's critical goods control. It's going to be very difficult for Chinese because we're now having a possible game changer in social media. Chinese social media is as vibrant, you know, Weibo and now Weixin, all this. I think it's going to make a challenge on this trying to control, because information control is one of the key areas, not, you know, let this not so freely flow, but social media try to break that kind of yoke. And so this kind of struggle going to be there, and that's the bigger challenge. And state capacity, too. You know, you cannot always rely on land, because land is limited. And in fact, now they're thinking to change that from that of land proceeds to that of taxation, real estate tax and other kind of taxes. And that, I would argue, would have political implications, because that you have to direct tax people. And that's already, you know, government is thinking about it, but I think it's going to be very difficult in next foreseeable future, next few years. So in summary, I think that Chinese government, Chinese regime under Xi Jinping is still struggling to find that balance to deal with this, you know, to deal with this new social demand. This Chinese dream, it's still remains to be a very vague and defined attempt, I would say, to revise and renew this old social contract that Deng Xiaoping entered with the Chinese people in 1979. That old social contract says, I will make you rich, and you do not, you know, challenge me. For 30 years, that worked. But now, Xi Jinping realized that's going to be hard. You cannot, because demand has changed. It's not all about money. It's about more. It's about corruption. It's about clean air. And to deal with that, I don't think it necessarily that the Xi leadership has come up with this very clear, new, defined new social contract yet.
Well, thank you all for very excellent presentations. I will make a few comments, and then we will open the floor to questions. It seems quite clear that Xi Jinping is a man in a hurry. He has created a sense of urgency, even crisis. As Professor Lambton said, he's doing many hard things at the same time, and personally identified himself with almost every important decision-making mechanism and decision. The top priority, I think, that Xi Jinping has is strengthening party legitimacy and control. In order to do that, he must transform the economic structure so that he can sustain China's development. And also, he must root out corruption. So his goals and indeed even the China dream, I think, is related to the reinvigoration of the party and its legitimacy. I think everybody has raised questions about whether Xi Jinping can succeed. Clearly, he faces many obstacles, many entrenched interests. There are people who have benefited from the way things have existed for some time. So as Professor Zhao has said to us, do we have Da Zhi or Da Luan? Is he going to succeed in having this great governance or fail and end up with some kind of chaos? So I think China watchers need to start thinking about what success and failure would look like and what its implications would be and what are indeed indicators of success and failure would be. The second question that I want to extend on remarks that Mike Lambton made about Chinese foreign policy. How do we understand the linkage between the internal reforms and policies and the external policies that Xi Jinping has been pursuing? Does China have to be tough? Does Xi Jinping have to have a very firm foreign policy in order to forge national unity, to gain support for this very difficult reform agenda that he is seeking to implement, so that he can just fight these battles at home and have everybody support him for what he is doing in defending particularly territorial integrity, sovereignty, China's core national interest? And if that is true, then how does that square with what is clearly another Chinese goal that Xi Jinping himself has recently enunciated or reiterated, that China needs a favorable international environment to continue to develop domestically? So there is a tension here. And I think that there is a potential that tensions that China has, particularly with its neighbors and with the United States, could have domestic negative domestic consequences. And I'll just give one very brief example, and that is Japan's investment in China, which has been very, very important to China's development. Japan's direct investment in China fell nearly 20% in 2013. And this year, the first 6 months, it dropped another 40% compared to a year earlier. So clearly, those are that is a phenomenon that has negative implications for China's economic development and for Xi's objective of achieving the China dream. I would argue that Xi Jinping seeks to achieve this this sweet spot of improving relations with China's neighbors without the appearance of making concessions. I think this was quite clearly stated at the October 2013 work conference on periphery diplomacy. China wants to share its economic growth and with its neighbors so that they can all benefit, but at the same time does not want to give an inch when it comes to sovereignty and territorial issues. I think this will be very, very challenging going forward, and I think we have to ask the question as to whether or not this very tough foreign policy towards neighbors on territorial issues is going to be counterproductive for Xi Jinping's domestic agenda, and whether he's going to be able to reconcile having this policy towards his neighbors and also trying to achieve a new great type of major power relationship with the United States. That also seems in conflict as well. So let me stop there, open up the floor for questions. We have, I think, 25 minutes. I'm going to collect a set of questions. If you have a particular person in mind that you would like to answer it, please do point that out and identify yourself when you state your question. Richard Bush, please.
Thank you very much. I'd like Mike Lampton and anybody else who wants to comment to elaborate on the tension that you identified between carrying out economic reform and doing anti-corruption at the same time. That seems to be a pretty difficult trick to pull off. Not only in the short term, I mean, you suggested that in this environment, people are going to want to put their heads below the parapet, and that would suggest that would argue against any sort of bold action, including in support of reform. But there may be a longer-term impact too. You know, who's going to be left to carry out the reform once the anti-corruption campaign is over? So, anything you'd like to say on that?
Okay, in the back.
Hi, I'm Yuda Cho, second year Asian Studies program student in George Washington University. I have a question on to all the speakers, if you would like to answer. All the speakers have mentioned there's a certain gap, social gap or social changes in China, and everybody's focusing on, like all over the world, is focusing on the internal problems that China's facing. Just like a couple of days ago on the Ministry of Foreign Affairs, their press conference, everybody's focusing about what happened to Jiang Zemin these days. So I think the internal problems are really important for us to observe, especially when observing the development of the Xi Jinping regime and all these kind of political changes. One question I would like to raise is how would Xi Jinping deal with the gap between the Han nations and the so-called minorities in China, including Uyghurs, Tibetans, and all these minority groups, because all these riots happened in Xinjiang or Xizang in Tibet has been observed, and what we can see is the cost of Weiwen to maintain the stability is raising, but these problems are still happening,
and it's not coming down, especially in recent years. So I would like to know more about how would Xi Jinping deal with all these kind of issues, especially facing these minority groups. Thank you.
Okay, we'll take a third question over here. Yes, you. Wait for the microphone, please.
Well, thank you. My name is Yan Kang from the School of Media and Public Affairs of George Washington University. We learned a lot of information from the presentations of Mr. Chai and Chow about the policies and the reforms of Xi Jinping since he took the office in 2013. And we know there's a lot of opportunities for the Chinese people to develop in the future. And I would like to know how could the Taiwan area could benefit from these policies and the reforms. And if these reforms succeed, how it would influence the cross-strait relations between the mainland and the Taiwan area. Thank you.
Okay, thank you. David Brown.
Dave Brown, this is a question for Professor Tsai. You did not mention how Taiwan fits into Xi Jinping's Chinese dream. The great rejuvenation of the Chinese nation is one of the ways he expresses that. And the Chinese nationalist perspective, reintegrating Taiwan with the motherland, would seem to be an element of it, and an element that he expressed in a statement he made in the spring of this year about how Taiwan could be integrated into the Chinese dream. So please explain how she thinks about this.
Okay, we'll take one last question from over there.
Hi, my name is Eva Maria. I'm from University of Turku in Finland. I have a question. What happened to the concept of rule of law in China? I don't mean the Western concept of rule of law, but the Chinese concept of yi fa zhi guo, or fa zhi, that was emphasized by Jiang Zemin earlier, and to some extent also by Hu Jintao. But in recent years, I haven't been noticed that. I haven't noticed that Xi would have given a lot of attention to it. Thank you.
Okay, we'll take this first group of questions, have some comments, and then we will come back for a second round. We'll start with Professor Lampton and Richard Bush's question about the tension between economic reform and anti-corruption.
Good question, and we should start with an observation of the obvious, and that is transparency is a problem. But I think you can sort of see four areas where there's tension, and starting from the premise that anti-corruption is a worthwhile effort. So nobody's, it's just what are the objective consequences, right? So I think it has an impact. You're going to have to go after the power structure itself or important parts of it. Zhou Yongkang is actually not only the petroleum sector but the security sector, and his tentacles go, and I think, to depths that most of us can't quite imagine. So you've got the power structure issue, and you see the same thing going after the PLA or certain parts of the logistical system and acquisition procurement and all of that. Hard to know. So you're going after the powerful bureaucracies, coercive bureaucracies, not limited to them, but including them. So I see a power structure pushback. It's hard for me not to imagine people are going to seek to defend themselves. And so, secondly, it seems to me there's a resource problem, and that is, I faithfully read the business page and so on. We seem to see capital flowing out of China into property markets all over Asia and in the United States and elsewhere. I can't think that on balance is a good sign. It seems to me that people are also stashing their kids around and diversifying residence and everything else. So those are all, it seems to me, signs of a lack of confidence, or at least we're going to hedge our bets in major ways. So there's a resource problem. Then there's an implementation problem. Are you going to get faithful implementation if everybody's got their head below the parapet? So I just think there's a bit of an implementation problem. Then there's the external threat issue. And you see already, I think, whatever the anxiety level was in Hong Kong before recent developments, it goes up. And I can't imagine people in Taiwan are looking at either developments on the mainland or in Hong Kong with entirely reassured of that. So you multiply the kind of unmanageable problems. And of course, people in, particularly in Taiwan, but in Hong Kong as well, want to get us involved in that. And from the PRC point of view, that's not a welcome development. So those are some of the areas. I thought I'd just say one word on the last question, if I could, the rule of law. It just seems to me, and I made a comment about the third plenum, it did talk a little about rule of law-related issues in a pretty positive way. Certainly the whole detention, administrative detention system was one topic, as I recall, and as I understand it, I don't follow it that closely. Been some progress in that area. I don't want to, I'm not quite sure how much. And then we have the fourth plenum coming up, about which that is supposed to be the topic. So I would say we ought to all pay attention to that.
Okay. Dr. Tsai, do you want to comment on how Taiwan fits into the Zhongguo Meng?
Thank you. Thank you. Actually, Chinese dream is very vague and non-meaningful dream. And Chinese dream also have the two category implication, international and domestic. The international implication is CCP emphasizes the Chinese nation is the law of peace and pay more attention to other nations' culture. And when CCP to do the international propaganda, CCP would not to emphasize the economic growth, emphasize the strong army, and so on. CCP hope to let the international to believe that China is love peaceful, is a nation to love peaceful, and so on. And however, in those domestic category, CCP emphasizes the Chinese dream involved some important policy. That is the very imperative problem in contemporary China. If CCP can resolve this problem, I mentioned, for example, social unfairness and anti-corruption, the CCP can practice the Chinese dream. So, In Taiwan, I don't know. We don't care about the Chinese dream, and it's very vague and non-meaningful. So when I received the topic to present it, I have some confused. So I injected some correct attribute to the Chinese dream. I believe Chinese dream is order to resolve this study problem. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Jianmin, could you comment on how Taiwan might benefit from China's reforms?
As I said earlier, there are two kind of prongs in this grand strategy to reshape China. Market liberalization, I think as the state-owned enterprises are to be stripped of some of the privileges, and small and medium enterprises are to be promoted in China. I think that's to our benefit, because that's what Taiwan's economy is based on, small and medium enterprises. So I would say that would be one area. And a similar relevant case is the Shanghai Free Trade Pilot Zone. I think it's trying to open up its market from there. Other cities might follow suit. And I think it has already opened up some opportunities for the Taiwanese business people. On the judicial reform, I'm afraid Taiwan will serve more like a model. I think there are many things many China can learn from the Taiwan experiences. Ours is not perfect. There is a long way to go before Taiwan reaches the level of a mature democracy in terms of the rigor of our democratic institutions. Nevertheless, ours is much better, you know, compared to in terms of transparency, accountability, and so on, balances of powers and so on and so forth. I think there's much we can offer to the other side, and I'm sure many people in the many China would like to, you know, pick up a lesson from here and there. On cross-strait relations, I think it really depends on how the outcome of the reforms are. If it heads on the good side, in other words, if it succeeds to some extent, you know, the economy has been transformed, the anti-corruption is relatively successful, budgetary reform, and the whole political system is more transparent. Of course, cross-strait relations will be benefited. But, you know, the problem with China is that there is a high level of uncertainty. If the reforms are heading not on the so good a direction, then I think you are going to see tensions there from within China. I think it's very likely that we are going to see, I agree with David Lampton's assessment, we are going to see more tensions in years and months ahead. I think this is not by no means easy sailing. I see many problems ahead, and you know, this is audacious endeavor, but with a lot of uncertainty. So if those tensions surface in China, of course we cross-strait relations will be negatively affected. Thank you.
Okay, and Dr. Liu, maybe you could comment on the relations between Han and the minorities and any of the other issues that you have comments on.
Great. In terms of the minority relations or ethnic relations in China, the policy, the new policy by Xi Jinping and the new leadership, I personally don't see there's much change in the policy toward minorities. I think the change, if any change, probably is that the in short term has step up more security measures. If you go to China, I think probably as a reaction or reactive policy toward the more recent expansion of attacks and terrorist attacks outside of a Xinjiang area. In more interior areas. So you can see that now, not only in Xinjiang, but also outside Xinjiang, in big cities, like throughout China, there's a lot more security measures, including not just airports, train stations, including subways. And that, you know, and that China has money to put in to hire that many people just to check your luggage, check your bags at, you know, even at, in subways. And buses now, they're trying to have a new measure in some cities, even in buses. Public buses. So you can see that in short term, they're obviously willing and able to spend more money into more security and one could say more repressive measures. But long term, I don't see there much change, because long term, this is continue from a Hu Wen era, and that is to their cooperation and more pumping more money, provide more opportunity, especially in Xinjiang area. And I think the Chinese realize that Xizang, Tibet and Xinjiang are quite different animals. They're dealing with two different issues. And on Xinjiang, this is obviously the most urgent and most pressing problem for them. So long term, I don't see that it has changed. In fact, I think they have stepped up more economic and more beneficial kind of policy towards Xinjiang. So there is a long term and short term. In short term, yes, we see that there are some changes. So the other issues about anti-corruption campaign is a very good question. I just want to add what Mike has already remarked. I think there's the challenge for Xi Jinping and Wang Qishan, and that is how to turn it off, how to overcome that moral hazard already built in. I say this because China had already have number of anti-corruption campaigns in the last 30 years. But people all expect it to be last year, less than a year, and then, boom, you're off to some other pressing issues. But this time, it's different. This time, it's 16 months and ongoing. But people already know that at some point it has to end, because already we can see certain backlash from the economic sector saying, wait a minute, this is, you know, state sectors and all that. Are you crying that, oh, this is when we're going to end this? And so the challenge is to how to temper that expectation. There's something at some point at the end, and then switch to some normal, new norm, new normal. And that's challenging, because Mike Lempton emphasized always on the implementation. China, I think Wang Qishan realized, you cannot always rely on this ad hoc inspectors like sending out from Beijing like the emperors always did. You have to rely on the rules, like declaration of assets, you know, prohibition of children's or wives now go to immigrate abroad, which already, you know, that's obviously trying to tighten those rules. But how to implement those rules while you kind of temper down, that's the hard part. They know that campaign cannot last forever, but they know that it's hard to end, because if you end, then they'll say, uh-oh, no, everything will be all right. Let's back to the good old days. So that's the tough part.
Okay. Great. I think we have time for maybe one or two more questions. In the blue shirt over here.
Thank you, Professor. Actually, I'm Jacob from Elliott School of International Affairs. I'm a first-year graduate student. I also have two questions for all the panelists. We see as before Chinese government centrally put out some important reforms, they will like try out in some local provinces or in smaller places. But how does this kind of try out, we call 试点, in fact, actually affect the ultimate policy of central government? And how will this try out affect the central and local relationship? And my second question is about the civil society, because we see that Professor Liu mentioned that the control on organization and information are still very strict. But with the growth of civil society, how can they play an important role in the for future reform in China society? Will the government try to lose the control on civil society organizations, or we say in Chinese, 社会团体, social groups? Thank you very much.
Okay, and one last question. Woman in the back over here. Yes, you.
Reporter from The Voice of America. My question is for Dr. Liu Xiaobo. You mentioned that in your speech that Xi Jinping, unlike Deng Xiaoping, Xi Jinping hasn't found a new social contract. So my thinking is, if Xi Jinping said, okay, I will give you more freedom, then you will certainly challenge my position. So what's your suggestion for the new social contract? Thank you.
Okay, let's please have brief answers so that we can get to lunch in a couple of minutes. Dr. Liu?
Yeah, for the last question, I don't have an answer. I don't know what she's – but that's what the demand is. But I wonder if he – so far I don't see any signs that this would be willing to sign or renew that kind of contract with that emphasis on more freedom and so on, or democracy. The first question is, I think it's again, it's not very hard to answer. I'm pessimistic. I don't think the regime would lose any time soon the organizational space, control of organizational space. We see case after case that you can say anything individually. You can do anything individually, even including protests and so on, but don't organize. And also, you know, let me get back a little bit. Sure, social organizations, 社会团体, do exist in China, and they will tell you there are millions of them now every day. Except, of course, the civil, when we talk NGOs or civil society, if you're the goals of civil society or NGO are different from that of the state, that's a trouble. If they overlap or something close, that's okay. Environmental protection, health, public health, and so on. Those okay. Those can flourish, survive, and flourish. All right. Except, of course, there are other issues that sometimes can. For example, education rights. But when education is okay, but then there are some groups trying to push for education rights, you know, for the kids from other provinces and so on. And they did, and then they were cracked down. So that's, you know, sometimes that's a very, that line, of course, always drawn by, that red line is always drawn by the state, by the government. And if you push that line, sometimes you got really trouble.
Okay, anybody, last comments from the panel? Okay. I think we've reached an end to the session. I want to thank all of our speakers for excellent presentations.